Hi, Richard Feidler here. Thanks for downloading this Conversations podcast. There are many, many more at abc.net.au/conversations.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations. Andrew Westholl is a former biologist and primatologist, which is someone who studies apes and monkeys. Andrew, though, is fascinated particularly by chimps. And why wouldn't you be? They're both utterly strange and eerily familiar at the same time. Andrew Westholl, a few years ago, took on a job for a while on a small farm surrounded by a moat in Canada, which was a sanctuary for retired chimps. And when I say retired, I mean retired from a life as test animals for medical research, or as circus performers, or pets. Andrew spent 10 months with these 13 chimps and gathered their stories. He watched them groom each other, he saw them play tickle chasey, and form alliances. We know that chimps are our close cousins, genetically speaking. Like us, they have rich emotional lives and a sense of selfhood. They're very social, they look out for each other, and at times they fight really fiercely too. As Andrew watched the chimps recover from the trauma of their early lives, they began to allow him to interact with them, which for Andrew was a profoundly moving experience. And the chimps even began to invade his dreams. Andrew Westholl's book is called The Chimps of Fauna Sanctuary, and he's in Australia as a guest of the Brisbane Writers' Festival. Andrew Westholl, hello.
Hi, Richard.
Describe this fauna sanctuary for me, please.
Absolutely. It's about a 240-acre hobby farm. And there's lots of different rescued animals there, but the most famous residents are these 12 chimpanzees. And they live right in the middle of the farm in this building that's sort of a mix between, it looks like a maximum security prison, but it's also a Zen sanctuary. It's sort of a retreat. And it looks from the outside, it's got this electric fence around it. It's surrounded by a moat because chimpanzees can't swim. And inside the chimp house is this incredible wall of caging. It's sort of one part Rube Goldberg and one part Alcatraz. And it's got all these tunnels and sliding pulley doors and playrooms and ropes and all sorts of things to climb on and hide behind. And this is where these chimpanzees call home.
And there are these skywalks as well, aren't there? Outdoor skywalks.
Yeah, there's one skywalk that goes out of the building, and on this skywalk, the chimps can go all the way out to this pond, this little man-made reservoir where they can watch the ducks, you know, spend their day on the water. And it's really quite a retirement home.
What does it sound like? Is it always noisy and chaotic?
Almost always incredibly noisy. Chimps, especially in an echo chamber like a chimp house, it is incredibly loud. A lot of people have heard of the pant hoot, the chimpanzee pant hoot. It's incredibly loud and ends with this gigantic scream. And they're also oftentimes pulling on the caging and hammering away or pounding the sides of their walls. So it's a cacophony in there.
So there's good screaming and bad screaming when it comes to chimps, isn't there? There's the scream of what joy and play, and there's a scream of horror.
Yeah,
and play.
Exactly. And the scream of welcome as well, and saying hello and good morning is also incredibly loud, and it's just a shriek.
But they would say good morning to you when you rocked up?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's more... I like to think, because I was a relative stranger, I would like to say that when I walked into the chimp house, it was more, we know you're here, buddy. You know what I mean? Whereas when Gloria, the woman who founded the place, it was much more, oh, goody, you know, our favorite person in the world is here. This is me projecting.
So it's a bit like an exclusive nightclub in that sense, too.
You know,
who gets past the person at the door is kind of who is the famous person. And, oh, we love you. And you, yeah, maybe.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll check you out.
It takes time.
Tell me about Gloria. She's such an amazing person, the woman who founded this sanctuary. Please.
She's an unbelievable person. She was running a grooming salon, one of the most successful grooming salons on the south shore of Montreal in Canada. And really just desperately wanted to do something really audacious in the name of animal rights. And through a long journey of discovery, realized that chimpanzees were the species she wanted to do something to help. And she knew about these chimps who were in this laboratory that was about to be shut down. And she and her partner, Richard Allen, a veterinarian, they poured their entire retirement savings into building this chimp house on this hobby farm of theirs. They'd already had a bunch of neglected animals rescued there, but they really wanted to make this the central piece of their farm.
Why chimps? Why chimps of all creatures?
You know, I think you and I both, we've just been talking about it. They're so compelling. They're so much like us. And I think Gloria had an experience on the west coast of America at another chimp sanctuary, and she witnessed them in the flesh, and she just knew at that moment, she blurted it out, "I need to start a chimp sanctuary," before she even really thought it through.
So she found a group of chimps who'd had a life of a kind of traumatic life, mm-hmm. brought them into the sanctuary. Mm-hmm. Once they were in, were they happy campers, or did that take a while?
Oh, it took years.
Years?
Years. The young guys, the young chimps, took a little less time to adjust and to start sort of playing with Gloria and her sisters through the caging. But you got to imagine these older chimpanzees that have been in the laboratory for decades. Every human they'd ever met wanted something from them. Wanted to either inject them with something, knock them unconscious, shoot them with a dart gun, or of course the people who would bring them their food were the same people. So they got to fauna, and they didn't know if this research was just going to start up again. So it took Gloria years to gain their trust.
Did it take her a while to realize even that?
Oh yeah,
that she had to think through why she wasn't being trusted.
Yeah, and she knew very little going into this. But you know what? Chimps are so much like us. And when a chimp ignores you for two straight years, like Tom did, you understand what's going on. You know you need to work on that relationship and do something to build that relationship. And that's exactly what she did.
Yeah, what strikes me about this remarkable woman is how persistent she is.
I can't get over it. I'm still, people ask me what is it about her that makes her do this, and I still don't know.
She stuck with a chimp that ignored her for 2 years. I think that's mm-hmm. lovely, too.
Yeah, and who became her greatest teacher.
When they went through this long period of not really responding to her care and not being terribly social, Jane mm-hmm. Goodall arrived, and
right,
which was lovely. She's been on this program the past two. She gave the place her blessing, which was a great relief.
Yeah.
What was her suggestion?
She had a few, but one of them, and this is the one that blew Gloria away, Gloria just assumed these chimps wanted to just cut ties with everything in their past. It would make sense that they wouldn't want to bring back memories from their past. Jane Goodall's suggestion was, before these chimps were in the lab, some of them had lives with humans. They were raised as human children in houses. So some of them had memories that were actually rather warm and comforting ones. And so Jane suggested she try to find objects that would bring back some of these memories for some of these chimpanzees. And it actually, you know, it was sometimes it would work and sometimes it wouldn't. There was one time where she brought in a guitar for Donna Ray, the chimpanzee. Donna Ray had been working at a talent agency, and she'd been taught to play the guitar and ride a tricycle at people's birthday parties. So Gloria thought, okay, I'll get her a guitar. Well, the second Donna Ray saw that guitar, she smashed it to smithereens.
Why?
You know, who knows? But the idea is, I would like to suggest that it was an awful memory. It was a memory of having been somewhat of a slave. Of having to work these parties day in and day out and to be treated awfully for your whole childhood. That's kind of what I think happened there.
The other idea that Jane Goodall had was food.
Mm-hmm.
What was her suggestion?
Give them the world. Give them a feast. In the lab they survived on monkey chow and water, which are just dried bricks of protein and water. And her suggestion was to bring all sorts of fruits and vegetables and vary it up and even bring foods from their past, like spaghetti. Billy Joe. Human food. When he first saw them eating spaghetti, the humans in the human area of the chimp house eating spaghetti, he went berserk. Because, as Glory would soon learn, Billy Joe used to eat spaghetti. It was his favorite meal with his owner. He even used to get in the car after eating spaghetti and drive to Dairy Queen for ice cream. So it's this sort of, Gloria was learning these things about the chimps all the time.
Many of these chimps had been, they'd gone through this interesting process of having been exposed to human culture as pets or as circus performers or performers of any kind. Mm-hmm. They'd been acculturated to become human. Mm-hmm. That's so interesting. And wanted human things and human activities. Tell me a bit about that and what you saw of that.
Yeah, I mean, a really good example of that is Sue Ellen, the chimpanzee, one of the oldest chimps at Fauna. She was raised in the circus for the first 13 years of her life, and she was always wearing these outfits. And it turns out her favorite thing to do still to this day, I think she's over 40, is to drape herself in human clothing. So part of the enrichment packages that are left in the chimp areas every week after the chimp house is cleaned are a whole ton of different pieces of human clothing. And that's really for Sue Ellen. And you'll see her walking around with a beaded necklace around her neck, halfway into a pink chemise. She'll have a sports sock on her hand. And it became a thing of comfort for her to have these sort of things from her past.
Andrew Westall is my guest in conversation. Andrew spent 10 months working as a volunteer in a chimp sanctuary in Canada. Chimps who'd been traumatized by their experiences in medical research laboratories or elsewhere. And his book is called The Chimps of Fauna Sanctuary. Now, let's bring you in here, Andrew. What were you doing? You sort of made a kind of an effort to work there about a decade ago. It didn't happen.
Right.
And then you came back. Tell me your story and how you came to be working there.
Sure. I was a biology graduate from university, and all I wanted to do was study animals. The only textbook I opened in university was the animal behavior textbook, and I read it cover to cover. And I tried to volunteer at Fauna at the time. One thing led to another. It didn't work out, but I got a dream job of my own, which was to spend a year in the upper Amazon basin studying wild troops of capuchin monkeys. They literally dropped me off with a bunch of aspiring primatologists, and we spent the year living in the jungle. And interestingly, I guess, while I was there, I kind of fell out of love with the idea of science, but I was always fascinated still by primates.
Why did you fall out of love with the idea of science?
I was having the experience of a lifetime in the jungle, and my role was to reduce it all down to numbers and group scans and canopy heights and group widths and what are the monkeys eating and who's friends with whom. In fact, who's friends with whom was the only stuff I was interested in, the social life of the monkeys. But I started keeping a journal and realized I wasn't keeping track of all the other things I was seeing in the jungle. It was a pristine jungle. It was the adventure of a lifetime.
What kind of connection did you really want to have then? Do you begin to realize that you really did want to have with primates?
I wanted to have a more visceral connection. I didn't want them to be the subject of a study. I wanted to build a relationship with them and try to understand them on their own terms, I think is really where it was for me. And I came home from there and, you know, I wrote my first travel memoir as a first book about Suriname. But then Fauna popped back into my head. And I realized I need to write about this place. I've always wanted to go there. It would be my life coming full circle to be a writer working with primates. And so one thing led to another again, and I was moving into Fauna.
What were your impressions when you arrived at that former chimp sanctuary?
Utter fear.
Why?
Because of the sound. I walked in. Gloria took me from the airport in Montreal straight onto the farm, all the way down to the chimp house, in the chimp house doors. And she did this on purpose. She didn't want me sitting around wondering what it was going to be like. She wanted me to feel it right away. And I say feel it because the chimp house is kept very humid, like a tropical rainforest where chimps live. And so you walk in and you're hit with this wave of stench, this neotropical stench, and this humidity that hits you. And then the banging starts because they know a stranger's in the house. And this is their home. And I'm walking down this corridor and they're pounding on the walls. And I'm totally struck with fear.
So what happens then? How do you then acclimatize?
It happens so quickly because the first chimp I met was named Binky.
Hello, Binky.
Yeah, otherwise known as the Bub or the Bubster. And he was immediately comfortable with my presence. He looked, he had his hair was up on end. He was stomping around. But once he saw that Gloria was okay with my presence, I spent the next half hour hanging out with Binky and watching Gloria interact with him. And then he just got a bunch of little gummy vitamins in his hand from Gloria, a little special treat, and he ran out the back of his room and everything was fine and all the screaming died down.
When you say hang out, do you mean in close physical proximity? Or was there a kind of a cage wall between
you? There's always a wall of caging between you. There's always, everywhere in the chimp house. You're never one-on-one with a chimp. And me especially, because I was a visitor.
Why?
They're powerful. And I don't think any of us fully understand them. And I think, and we all know, we've all heard the stories about chimpanzees that can attack people and hurt them for a whole variety of different reasons. It should be noted that no chimp has ever attacked a human without being profoundly messed with first, whether it's being taken out of the wild, raised in a lab, raised in a human home. But the fact is they're incredibly strong. They're seven times as strong as you, Richard.
Seven times?
Seven times. Now, I don't know you that well. Maybe 10 times. Who knows?
Maybe you want to hack that up to 11. I don't know.
Very powerful guys, and their wrists are the width of my neck.
Yeah, the temptation, I suppose, is to think because they're smaller than us, that they're weaker than us. Oh, no.
No, and you know what? They're not really that much smaller than us. You think of a chimp. Most people out there think a chimpanzee is what they see on television when they see a chimpanzee. Those are infants. Those are babies. Those are juveniles. A grown male chimp can get up to 200 pounds. When he's standing on his back legs, he can be almost 5 feet tall. I mean, these guys are, and they're bound with muscle, bound with it. They're incredibly powerful, but also incredibly graceful because they're tree dwellers. So the way they move that immense weight through the chimp house, you know, grabbing onto the ropes and grabbing onto the caging and sweeping through the air, I mean, it's an unbelievable thing to watch.
What's it like to stand up close next to a chimp that's on its leg, that's sort of looking at you as a fellow primate and look into its eyes? What kind of, I mean, we're always projecting onto these creatures. We can't help it. It's who we are as well.
Right.
I just wonder what it's like to be in the presence of such a powerful, charismatic animal that's as close to us, but not us, as you can get.
There's no experience like it on Earth. There's nothing else a human can experience that approaches looking into the eyes of a chimpanzee or not even looking into the eyes, being in their presence, having their awareness fully on you and your awareness fully on them it's otherworldly.
You smell their breath.
Oh yeah, their vegetal breath and you see the way they move. They're very gestural. They use their bodies to speak. They never point. If they want you to look somewhere, they turn their body towards it. So you become really attuned to the way they move their body and they speak to you with their body language. And it's a whole different way of interacting with another being.
So when they're looking at you, perhaps they're sensing your deep interest and perhaps even love at some point, tinged with a little bit of fear that's got to be there too.
I think so. I think so. And you know, I like to think that as the time went on, that the fear was gone. But they're still quite foreign to me at that point. And I still wasn't really... I wasn't familiar with all of their movements, and so sometimes they would do something that would frighten me. But
what are the do's and don'ts when you walk into a chimp sanctuary?
Well, as for me, who's 6'4" and pretty broad, crouch down, look smaller, take off my jacket. Don't look so big and black and you know threatening. I had to not stand too close to Gloria at first because they would take that as a threat to their sort of maternal figure. It didn't take long for me to be able to interact with them in a much more casual way. But the key is that there were red lines on the floor. The floor was a grid of red lines, and the red lines were all around the areas where a chimp could reach out through the caging to get their food. And they have incredibly long arms, and they'll often only put half of their arm out through the hole because they want you to come close. They're just teasing with you and playing with you, but then they'll grab you. So,
and what happens when they grab you?
Well, it never happened to me. And usually what happens is they grab you, they pull you to the caging, and then they let go. they're just playing and testing you and sort of testing your sort of, well, testing your strength, but also sort of your trust.
Is there an element of prankishness about that too?
Oh, especially with Binky. Binky was a practical joker. He did anything he could to get a laugh. And chimpanzees do laugh. Now, I don't think they laughed at Binky's particular practical jokes. It was more the humans.
Let's make the hairless ape scream with terror for just a minute and then let him go.
Oh, you spend 10 minutes with Binky and you understand that look in his eye.
Andrew Westholm is my guest in conversation. He's an author, former biologist and primatologist who spent 10 months interacting with the chimpanzees of a chimp sanctuary in Canada. And his book about it is called The Chimps of Fauna Sanctuary. He's in Australia as a guest at the Brisbane Writers' Festival. How do they eat? Do they eat like, are there kind of strict rules of social engagement, or is it more like a kind of a football team of teenage boys?
No. They take their turns. Remember that all the chimps are living in different social groups at any one time. And they're the groups that they're most comfortable living with. But there's always someone in that group that gets to eat from the trolleys first. So these big trolleys are wheeled over with a smorgasbord of fruits and vegetables. Any fruit and vegetable on earth is on this trolley. And bottles of water. And so Tom, for example, he was a very senior member of this family. He would get to eat first from the trolley. He would get to pick what he wants, which was usually green apples and endives, because those were his favorite. Green apples from Washington State.
All right. He was a gourmand, was he?
Yeah, he was. He was a foodie in the chimp world. But then also, they also loved tea. They loved to drink Tetley tea. Tom started this because he saw his best human friend, a man named Pat, drinking tea, and he really wanted a sip. The second Tom got a cup of tea, he kept asking for another one. Soon all the chimps are drinking tea, hot tea. Some of them will poke a hole in the top of their water bottle when you give them a hot cup of tea, and they'll pour water into it to let it cool off.
Can 11s be far behind? I wonder.
Exactly.
Tell me about the day Tom, the senior chimp, and some others got out of their enclosure.
Yeah, absolutely. Tom had heard one night, as Gloria was going around locking all the locks on the doors, that one of them had failed. And they're very good at listening and hearing this sort of stuff. And the second the humans had left the chimp house that night, Tom let himself out through that lock. The problem was Tom was not living alone. He was living with Pepper and Sue Ellen and Regis and Jethro and Rachel, all his best friends. So Gloria's sister Linda, in the morning, gets to the chimp house, walks in, and sees Tom sitting in the laundry room, which is a human area. And she says, "Hi, Tommy," and casually walks out of the building, calls Gloria.
Oh, my God!
Yeah, freaking out, right? Yeah. I mean, they have good relationships, but still freaking out. Calls Gloria. Gloria immediately knows the problem because he's living with six other chimps. Gloria spends the whole rest of the day walking around the chimp house in bitter January cold, trying to calm down the six chimps who've escaped. Sue Ellen and Pepper never left their enclosure. It was like they were sitting there watching the whole drama unfold. They could have had a box of popcorn. And Regis finally went back into his enclosure. Jethro went back into his enclosure. Soon it was just Tom and Rachel, who Gloria felt comfortable with. She went in with her sisters to start cleaning up. And Richard, what they saw in there was unbelievable. In the laundry room, the chimps had poured detergent on the ground, and there were a whole bunch of brooms lying around. In the kitchen, the sink was filled with soapy water, and all the dirty dishes had been thrown into the sink. And the oven door was pulled open. There was oven cleaner squirted all over the inside of the oven, and there were sponges in there, and they tried to sponge the oven. So the key here is when Tom and Rachel and all their friends were presented with the closest thing to freedom they'd ever seen, all they wanted to do was act like their human friends. It was incredible.
I like the fact that they had the proper detergent on the floor and the oven cleaner in the oven.
Exactly.
They watch really carefully then.
Oh, they learn everything from watching. They're like humans in that way.
That's so delightful. There's something really makes me happy to hear that. I don't know.
Yeah.
And how well did they clean? Was it probably it was pretty mucky, I suppose.
It was their first go.
Yeah,
right?
Their first go, right. They're like kids in that sense, aren't they?
Exactly.
Yeah. You started having dreams about Tom, didn't you? Tell me about your dreams, please, young man.
I'll keep to the Tom dreams for your sake. But you know, everyone who works with chimpanzees for any length of time starts dreaming about them. They work themselves into your dreams just like your human friends do, just like any human in your life. And Tom started visiting my dreams. The first time he did so, I felt like I was in the presence of the Godfather. And he was looking at me and he was approaching me, and I didn't know what to do. And I didn't even realize I was dreaming, obviously, and it was terrifying. Soon the dreams started to morph into these sort of slapstick comedies. One of the dreams, Tom and I were sitting in the fauna pickup truck, and we were desperately trying to drive off of the property. And I couldn't get the gear shift to work, so Tom would look over at me and scream, you know, shriek with that chimp pant hoot. We'd get out of the car, we'd run around the hood, we'd trade places. Tom would get in and he would stick it in gear and drive away. And then he wouldn't do it very well and he wouldn't be able to steer very well, so we'd get out and switch again. So we drove a car together. When I was sleeping outside at one point in a tent, Tom opened up my tent at one point and came in and hung out for a bit. I still dream about him occasionally. It's been a while since I've seen the chimps.
What kind of longing do you think that reflects within you?
Oh, I think it's what I know on some deeper level, and I don't think it's just me, you know, having been a primatologist and followed this kind of world. I think all of us have this innate longing to connect with our closest evolutionary cousins.
Listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
Living with chimps is our theme today, and Andrew Westholl is my guest. Andrew is a former biologist and primatologist. He's now a writer, and he spent 10 months volunteering at the Fauna Sanctuary for Chimps in Canada. His book is called The Chimps of Fauna Sanctuary. The chimps that were there, that had been subject to medical research, what kind of life had they had before they arrived at the sanctuary, Andrew?
You know, most of them had been born in a laboratory. They'd been taken from their mothers just days after they were born, which is always what happens. Then they're raised in a sort of a surrogate nursery by female humans, by women, taking care of them as if they were their own. And they're raised in this surrogate nursery until they're ready to go into the research. And they go into somewhere called Junior Africa, which is their first time that they're going to be living in a cage. And from then on, they're knocked unconscious, either through an injection, but usually because they won't present for an injection. They get shot with a dart gun. That's the main way that they knock chimps unconscious in labs.
And once a chimp is knocked down by the dart gun, how does that affect the other chimps who are watching all this?
They go berserk. A chimpanzee watching another chimp, the chimp is freaking out because they go unconscious and they believe they're about to be killed. I mean, I know that's projecting, but when all the other chimps in the unit, nine other chimpanzees, see this happen and then the chimp is taken out, and perhaps never to return, what else are those chimps going to be thinking other than that dart gun brings death or brings an end to their friend or family member? So it's total paranoia when the lab tech walks in with the dart gun.
And the nature of the research?
So the research is usually involves injections with lethal human viruses. So over the years, these chimps had been injected with multiple strains of HIV, multiple strains of hepatitis. Those are the two main projects that these chimps were used for.
Do they then suffer from those conditions the same way that humans do?
They actually don't. They don't suffer any of the symptoms, which you would think means they would be useless as a study subject. The virus does actually propagate in their veins, in their blood system. So really what's happened is the vast majority of research with chimpanzees on lethal human viruses has been pretty well a waste of time. They were used in the hepatitis B vaccine, but they were just used as living test tubes, really, to grow the vaccine. They never developed any of the symptoms. HIV, the HIV project that involved over 100 chimpanzees in America, was an utter failure. And everyone agrees that it was an utter failure. The big issue was the American government started a huge breeding push because they figured they could cure HIV using chimps. And then that left the states, once they realized this wasn't working, with a huge surplus of research chimps. and scientists had to find something to do with them. So they started justifying keeping them in laboratories by doing other kinds of work. And barely any of it has helped. And there's been tons of papers published now summarizing the chimps' contribution to biomedical research, and it has been next to nothing. And considering the suffering that it has caused, I mean, not only are they getting injected with these viruses, they're living alone in cages, which for a social animal like a chimpanzee is akin to torture. It's like putting a human in a cage. Then they're also put through punch liver biopsies.
What are they?
So that's when, without actually opening up the chest cavity or the body, a needle is punched through the entire muscle cavity of your body into the liver and wrenched out, and it brings out a piece of the liver for a test to see how the virus is propagating or whatever it is. And these, Yoko, one of the chimps at Fauna, Yoko went through a punch liver biopsy every 2 weeks for, I believe it was 3 years. And you do not just recover from this. And the list goes on.
But there must be some medical purpose to these things. I mean, scientists just don't keep doing this year in, year out if there's no scientific purpose to it.
You know, they say that we haven't got any results from it. And it's at the point now where 80 to 95% of the chimps who are in laboratories in America right now are being warehoused. They're not even being used because they're either too old or too, you know, quote unquote, dirty. They've been used in too many studies to be even used. Breeding has been outlawed. We're getting to the point now where people are realizing this has been pretty well a waste of time. It's by far the most expensive laboratory animal to keep in a lab. And the science just isn't producing anything worthwhile.
I've seen some of the university's propaganda it's put together about the animal research facility in the United States. It's absurd. I mean, it really comes down to propaganda. It's rather odd seeing some of the documents. I just looked open-mindedly, looked to see, oh, well, what are the medical risks? And I just saw nothing but absurd propaganda at the time.
It's unbelievable. And you know, animal research, especially chimp research, anything involving the great apes or primates or monkeys, has an enormous PR problem. And the only reason, I believe, that a lot of this stuff is still going on is because they can be silent and no one really knows what's going on. That's why I wanted to write this book.
The Soviet Union under Stalin was prone to all kinds of crackpot scientists who say, you know, Comrade Stalin, I believe we can, you know, create a strain of wheat that's 19 foot tall or something, and so say, go to it. What kind of research into chimps did Stalin authorize in the Soviet era?
Well, the big famous one that he did, and these documents were apparently only released a few years ago or uncovered, was that he had one of his top biologists try to impregnate female chimps with human sperm to create this sort of wonder race, this super race of labor and of military strength, to create this human Z of lore who would fight their wars and you know, do all of their menial labor. I mean, ridiculous. And because they're different species, impossible.
And the thought behind that is
so disturbing.
It's unbelievably monstrous.
It is. And the reason I include that in the book is because it's the most extreme example of the monstrous things that have happened. But really, so much of our relationship with chimpanzees over the last 100 years have strains of that kind of monstrosity.
One of the most interesting series of scientific experiments were done by an American scientist called Harry Harlow with rhesus monkeys, I think, wasn't it? In the 1950s. Mm. And it was into research into the ability of animals to love, really. It was essentially mother love. Tell me a bit about those experiments and what Harry Harlow found with rhesus monkeys.
Absolutely. So the big famous experiments he did were with these surrogate mothers, and he put a baby rhesus monkey into a cage with two different surrogate mothers, like built out of mesh wire. Okay, so one of them is just it's a doll, and it's made out of mesh wire, and it's covered with really cozy, sort of comfortable, soft fur. And then the other surrogate mother is just this wire mesh. And then what he would do is he would give either the soft and cozy mother the milk, a bottle of milk, or put that bottle of milk with the mesh-covered one, and, you know, the cold, hard one. And what he found was that the baby monkeys no matter where the milk was, the food, the sustenance was, preferred to spend almost 23, I think, out of 24 hours a day on the cloth mother, the one that gave them that comfort, that contact comfort, as it's called in the science. So even if the milk, even if their food, their, for their survival, is over at the mesh cold mother, the monkey will just run over there, grab a drink of milk, and run right back to the soft mother, the cloth mother. And what this shows is that contact, warmth, embrace, that's feeling of being embraced, a hug is almost more important to a baby primate than food.
That's when the experiments got a little cruel, because he also experimented when cloth mother was devised to suddenly repel the baby.
Exactly.
And not want the baby back with all sorts of ways. Electrification, wasn't it? Or catapults, spikes?
Harlow sometimes. Was a special guy.
He's a real special character.
He would put spikes, retractable spikes, into the cloth mother. And so while the baby is sitting there with the cloth mother, they would get jabbed with these spikes that would come out and then retract. And the baby would run away screaming, but would always run back to the cloth mother, no matter what. He built a catapult into the cloth mother, and it would shoot the monkey across the room. The baby would return to the cloth mother. Electrocution.
And apparently, despite of all this, this is the thing that breaks my heart about these stories. Sometimes the baby monkey would caper and try to win back the affection of the cloth mother.
Right. Right. I mean, it believed that this item that was giving it this comfort was alive. And could be negotiated with. I mean, the first negotiation a baby monkey learns is that between its mother and it over weaning. And so, you know, all of its learning begins with its mother in those first weeks and months.
So that's what that tells us about monkeys, primates, and to some degree ourselves as well, the importance of... I mean, it's a kind of common sense thing that everyone knew anyway, but science didn't believe it until Harlow had done these
experiments.
It's
amazing how many things science has to do that our sensing bodies already know, but they need to prove it. And I mean, then Harlow went on to stick baby monkeys in the bottom of, you know, into isolation chambers just to see what would happen. I mean, that was even more depressing.
And so they became traumatized.
Utterly, utterly comatose and traumatized and unable to be social again.
Tell me about Toby, one of the chimps in this enclosure you're at Fauna Chimp Sanctuary. Toby's story is really very, very powerful.
Toby lived for the first 26 years, I think, 23 years, at a zoo in northern Quebec. And he and his adoptive brother there, two chimpanzees that loved hanging out, over a long weekend were left outside with no water over a scorching hot long weekend. And by the Tuesday morning, when everyone came back to work, they found that Toby's brother Benji had died. And Toby was sitting there with Benji's body just howling and shrieking, mourning the loss of his brother. And this...
Died from dehydration.
Dehydration. And Gloria had tried time and again to get Toby out of this zoo. This was the final moment that allowed, she actually got Jane Goodall to write a letter to the zoo and to the wildlife authorities in Quebec to release Toby to Fauna, because he was just so traumatized now. So Toby finally was knocked unconscious, put in a truck, taken to Fauna, where he could have somewhat of the retirement he deserved. The trouble is, he's a zoo chimp being released, not into, but living in the same building as a whole bunch of lab chimps. And chimpanzees are not very good with intruders, with new individuals. And Toby was completely out of his element, had no idea what was going on, didn't know how to react. He'd built no social skills because he'd never lived in a group of chimpanzees. He'd only lived with one. And over the next 5 years, had a desperate time trying to fit in with the chimps. And at one point, on one day, Toby was attacked.
How was he attacked?
He was attacked in the classic chimpanzee attack where they...
How did they get to him?
Yoko broke through a weak piece of the welding in the caging, and he just desperately wanted to get in there. And he broke through and got in with Toby, and it let all the other chimps in, all the lab chimps in. And they all partook, most of them partook in this savage beating that they laid on Toby. And in a way a chimp attacks an intruder to protect their territory, you know, they attack the face and the eyes, they attack the hands and the feet, They go for the limbs first, and once they're incapacitated, they then go for, you know, what in the wild would be the finish, which would be the gut shot and attacking the genitals. And it was quite vicious. No one who works at fauna will ever forget that day.
What could they do as they observed this taking place?
This is the whole point of fauna, actually. I'm glad you asked that. The humans are actually completely powerless. When the chimps really want to do something, they do it. And so can you imagine spending your whole, you know, the last 10 years of your life trying to build this place for these chimps and then realizing in that moment you actually have very little control? I mean, you can keep them in the building, but Gloria was obviously traumatized by the experience. Everyone who worked there was. And Toby recovered.
How badly was he injured?
Very badly. He lost two of his fingers.
What, bitten off?
Bitten right off. His scrotum was you know, sliced open. And if it wasn't for Richard, Gloria's husband, who was a veterinarian, people are pretty sure Toby wouldn't have made it.
The group of chimps that attacked him had the nickname the Hoodlums.
Right.
What was special about them? What made them the Hoodlums?
Yeah, you know, Gloria, I think, was a little nervous about me using the term Hoodlums because it makes them sound like innately violent. And they're no more innately violent than humans are. But they're the Hoodlums because they had to raise themselves. They were like a gang of street kids in the laboratory because they had no mother figure. I mean, they eventually adopted a mother figure in there named Annie. But really, they had to learn how to be by themselves and as a group by themselves. And so the Hoodlums are the most tight-knit group at Fauna. They kind of run the show. They have sort of the pick of the best places. They eat first, usually. And if you don't feed the Hoodlums first, there can be a problem.
The kind of research that was, medical research that was done in an institution on these lab chimps that was called LEMSIP, which I think stands for, can you translate that acronym for us?
Yeah, it's the Laboratory for Experimental Medicine and Surgery in Primates.
Okay. And there was a chief vet there, James Mahoney.
Mahoney, yeah.
Mahoney, I beg your pardon. Tell me about how he went kind of rogue on that institution.
It's an amazing story. It's a book all its own. James Mahoney spent 20 years working with the chimps at LEMSIP, developed incredibly close relationships with the chimps, saw them from the age of zero to, you know, 20, but also was the one who had to give the kiss of death. He had to decide which chimps went into which study, who would be living alone for the next 6 months, and he learned slowly how traumatized they became by this. Even just the living conditions traumatized the chimps. One day in 1997, James Mahoney finds out that the lab is closing down and all the chimps in there, all of his close friends with this really complicated relationship, have been sold to one of the most notorious labs in the States. And what he does is he makes this plan to smuggle over 100 chimpanzees out of LEMSIP in the dark of night across a series of weeks to sanctuaries all across North America. And Gloria's sanctuary was the only one in Canada, and she got a phone call one night from James Mahoney saying, "We're ready to go." And there's actually footage of this because National Geographic caught wind of it and did a whole special called The Chimp Rescue on getting these chimps out in the middle of the night.
He did that without approval of...
Without approval. He only told a select few of his most trusted staff. And then I think when the lab shut down, he retired. And I've never actually been able to figure out if there were any repercussions for him. But it was actually quite a brave thing to do.
What happened when former lab workers at LEMSIP wanted to visit the fauna chimp sanctuary and see their former charges living a much better life?
Well, you know, at first Gloria didn't want to let them come. She figured the last thing the chimps need to do is see the humans that had hurt them so much. But then she realized actually one day when she was playing a video, a home video from LEMSIP, and she played the video in the chimp house for the chimps to watch. And the chimps were freaking out. They were just petrified by the sounds. And Gloria realized, oh my God, I can't believe I just subjected them to this memory. And just as she was about to shut off the video, this woman's voice came on, and it was the voice of Nancy. And Nancy had been one of the surrogate mothers in the lab. And Regis and Jethro raised them all from babies. And the screaming stopped, and all the chimps came to the front of their enclosures, and they heard Nancy's voice, and they started hugging each other, and they were totally thrilled to hear this voice. And so Gloria knew at that moment, I got to start letting them come. They've built these relationships. Even though they've been hurt, they were the only humans they had. Kind of like the Stockholm Syndrome, but I think even deeper. And so one time, this lab worker named Dave came, and this is the most powerful moment. He came to the sanctuary. Gloria took him in the back to see his favorite chimpanzee. He'd worked with Pepper at LEMSIP for years. Pepper was way up on one of the trees, one of the climbing trees. She hadn't seen Dave in a decade. I think about a decade. She saw him, came running down just as fast as she could, pressed her whole body up against the caging right in front of Dave, and pursed her lips through the caging. And Dave, Gloria looked at Dave, Dave looked at Gloria, and Dave's like, I don't know what she's doing. She hates me. I did so many awful things to her. And Gloria said, clearly she does not hate you. And it took Dave every inch of bravery in him to lean forward and touch his lips to Pepper's. And Pepper ran, just screaming with happiness, ran right back up to her tree. Dave collapsed in a fit of sobbing because he'd just been given what, you know, in his mind was a small piece of forgiveness.
Absolution.
Mm-hmm.
From a chimp.
Yeah.
It sounds like he needed it.
I think they all do.
They all do. Maybe get them in one by one and see what happens as you do that.
Yeah.
When you think of your own interaction with these chimps and you think back, what are some of the most powerful moments for you interacting with these chimps?
I think one of the most happy memories I have is when Regis, for the first time, Regis was a tough guy to get to know when he first presented to me to play. And
how do they do that?
Well, he just came right up to the caging in front of me. I was just standing there watching him and Jethro. And he stuck his fingers through the caging and he sort of hung his whole body from his arms and he just sort of juked his head up and down. And he went, like that. And I just knew immediately what he was doing because I'd never seen him do this before with me. And I'd seen him do it with the other caregivers. And for the next half hour, he would pound on the caging in front of me and then he would run away and go traipsing around the playroom. And eventually Jethro just heaved his massive body up from the ground and joined Regis, and he went around like the Pied Piper, and soon Jethro was following him, and I can't remember who else was following him, and they were following, and then they would come back to me, and they would play with me through the caging and sort of bang on it and huff at me, and then they would go for their little Pied Piper walk again. And it was just the most incredible experience because it was the first time I'd noticed a real change in the way they were okay with me being there finally.
Have you ever seen examples of chimp laughter, in fact, chimp hilarity? Like complete, because my view is that I've seen dogs laugh. I know I've seen dogs laugh at my expense.
Oh, I know. I feel the same way.
Chimps though.
Chimps absolutely have a laugh. Anyone who's worked with chimps knows this. It's a glorious huffing sound. Just like that. It's very low. And I've made a chimp laugh, not at Fauna. I just got back from Congo in Africa where I was visiting Jane Goodall's sanctuary there for orphan chimpanzees. And I was actually able to spend hours tickling infant chimps. And they laugh exactly like that. And they love it. And they lean into it and they have a ball.
Do they let you go again, though? I mean, do they not come back anymore?
Oh, no, then you're stuck with them for the whole day.
You're stuck there until they're bored with it, right.
That's it.
You're tickling chimps all day then after
yeah.
that, are you?
And it's really not the worst way to spend your day.
That's fantastic. My guest in conversation is Andrew Westall, who's a former biologist, primatologist, who volunteered to work at this amazing chimpanzee sanctuary in Canada called Fauna Chimp Sanctuary. In all this time, playing around with these chimps, having so much fun, You must have felt you had to leave at some point. How did that come about? And having to leave, and how painful was that?
It was really difficult. I felt really guilty. I had a book to write, right? Like I was there. Gloria had invited me there to write their biography. And I had to get working on it eventually. I mean, I was working when I was there every night in my apartment. But I had to leave eventually, and I felt guilty because I was leaving all the humans behind to do the hard work. You know, I had done some of the hard work and it had almost broken me. It was tough, tough work. So I felt guilty and I also just felt, you know, I'm going to miss these new friends. And I desperately wanted to convince myself that they would miss me. I think the truth of the matter is somewhere in between, where maybe they were wondering where the tall, strange intruder was for a while and then maybe forgot about me. I haven't been back. I've tried to go back. It just hasn't worked out. But it was really tough to leave. But then I spent a whole year in a room remembering it all writing it down, which was almost more difficult and more amazing.
The senior one, Tom, you mentioned, he's since died. What happens when a chimp dies, and how does it affect the other chimps?
Chimps have really complicated, complex mourning rituals that they do when a chimpanzee dies. Many animals do, but the chimps are the most sort of obvious. When a chimp dies at fauna, Gloria will leave their body in an area where all the chimps can get to it, and they'll hold a visitation of sorts. And so the females will come up and spend a lot of time grooming the body. They will groom them to the point where they are immaculate. They will pick every little piece out of their nails, groom all their hair to make sure they're utterly clean, and then they'll leave.
Is this a quiet process, or is there wailing?
The wailing happens with, I think, more with the juvenile males, the younger males, like Binky. Binky, actually, when Annie died, who was like his surrogate mother, when Annie died, he actually picked up her body and started tossing it around the room, trying to wake her up or do something to figure out what's going on with Annie. Annie's actually nose got bloodied during this. Rachel, the chimp, went and got some paper towels, came back in and cleaned up Annie's bloody nose. So they were grooming them. The boys were sort of just overcome. And one by one, they just leave the room. And once Gloria sees that the visitation is over, that she knows she can go in there safely and you know, take the body out. And I think she cremates most of them, actually.
It's an amazing story. I know that part of the profits off this book go to the Fauna Chimp Fauna Lifetime Care Fund.
Yeah.
So it's a great thing. What a great story. Thank you so much for sharing it with us today, Andrew.
Oh, thanks for having me in. That was great.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.